All right, guys, what's up? It is week 356. Feeling a little run down, so mistakes will be made. Excuse King. First one up is some Radiance films. This is a period piece, Olivasant, which is essentially a character's name. Even the name is kind of almost a premonition for this character in here. So this follows the story of the Marciano Messastrani, who is an excellent actor. He's in La Dolce Vita, 8 and a Half, Ghost of Love. Really strong Italian actor. And he plays this kind of coward that's involved with these rebels. And he's supposed to be a major important part of this uprising. In the very beginning, he is kind of released unceremoniously from this prison. And they kind of are kicking him and he leaves. And he was obviously a prisoner of this. And right away, he is kidnapped by his old comrades. And they believe that he ratted them out. And they're missing one of their higher-ups, which he was. So he's kind of blamed for all these things. And within the first minute, the first like 20 minutes when they find out he's not responsible, he kind of feels, you know, almost alienated throughout the entire rest of the film. And I don't know if he was a coward in the beginning, but after that, he's always trying to find a way to get away from them, trying a way to get clean and everything like that. Run away with his girlfriend, his wife, and his child, and all these things. Mimsy Farmer is also in this movie. Mimsy Farmer, I know from stuff like, you know, Four Flies on Grey Velvet, and Autopsy, and a slew of other, you know, kind of Italian genre films. She was more of a, you know, an actress that they mentioned in the special feature. She bounced between Italian genre films and like bigger films. This is one of the bigger films. Now, I feel like this movie is a very expensive period piece, and I'm thinking, from my understanding, it probably didn't get the love and recognition that it actually deserved. Again, catching a pattern here. A lot of the stuff that Radiance Films or Arrow has been putting out, this kind of movies that either cost a lot of money or really well made and just weren't really received or didn't get the attention, well received or didn't get the attention that they probably deserve and kind of are ripe for rediscovery. As of late. And this one is. I think the acting is tremendous. I think that it's kind of a tragedy of errors. And almost, if it wasn't played so straight, although it is comedic. Claudio Casanelli from all the Sergio Martino films pops up in here. And he plays kind of a comical character who has kind of a suicidal streak. He is always dedicated to Messastrani throughout the entire film. And it gets to the point where it's this almost ridiculous. He pops up trying to sell ice cream as he's hidden, as they try to buy guns. But the ending is pretty dark and has absurdist kind of hallucinatory qualities. All around, it's a good, interesting film. It's a gorgeous-looking movie. The Blu-ray looks great. As far as the special features are concerned, we have commentary by critic Michael Brook, archival interview by critic Gideon Bachman, in which filmmakers Paolo Tavani, Florestano Vassini, Nello Risi, and Anna Gabi discuss filmmaking approaches, the role of the director of the future cinema, and more. Original trailer, newly translated English subtitles, all that good stuff there. So check it out if it sounds like it's up your alley. I think it's quite good. I think it's interesting. It's definitely a period piece of a lot of rich people and politics, but also an uprising that someone doesn't want to partake in. All right, next one up is from Full Moon Entertainment, and this is Sea People from 1992 from the director of Demonic Toys. What is this director's name? Peter Manoogian? I never could say his name right. But this movie I grew up with, it was just one of those ones. Look at that classic cover. If you are a video store kid or anything like that, you're going to pick up Seed People. It's essentially, some people compare it to Colored Out of Space, the Lovecraft, but it's a body snatcher story, even from the structure. It's taking structure from the original 56 version here with Kevin McCarthy telling everyone what happened, and it has that kind of structure here, right? So we have this guy waking up in kind of a hospital, and he's being interviewed by like one of these guys who always played like a detective. I think he played a detective in a TV series, and he's basically saying, you know, what happened, yada yada yada, and he goes to the story about this small town that he used to be from, where his girlfriend, his ex-wife, lives now and runs a bed and breakfast. And he has to go back there to do some kind of experiments, and what happens is there's a meteor that lands, and it's carrying these seeds. It's carrying seed people, and the seeds kind of start overtaking people and turning them into monsters. There's kind of three prevalent monsters in the film. We have the flying creature here, then we have the roller, and then we have one that shoots kind of weird kernels of popcorn at people that kills them. It's all kind of absurd. I think that's what that creature does. They're fun. They're very Full Moon. They're very Charlie Band, small little creatures doing crazy things. Most of it's practical. There is some weird kind of, at the time, I guess you'd call it digital effects that are kind of meh. But this is the first time I'm watching this in HD. And to be honest, I there's colors that were popping on these creatures. I didn't know this guy had green on him. I was like, oh shit, man, there's a bunch of detail on this guy I never noticed. The monsters look pretty good. The plot is pretty simple. It's very paranoia, you know, seed people kind of storyline, except with monsters in it. It's like, let's just do body snatchers, but let's add creatures. It's like, that's essentially what they're doing here. It's fine. It's very serviceable. It's a perfect video store rental. I don't know how to explain this, and I'm not trying to be offensive, but when you're out at a campground and you go to like a local mom and pop video store, and they have a small selection, but it's all real weird shit. This is a perfect campground movie that you watch in a little tiny VCR on a 13-inch TV, and you love every second of it. That's Seed People. As far as the special features, it's classic Video Zone and Full Moon trailers. Love the old Video Zones. Some behind-the-scenes footage there. But yeah, this is a fun, solid Full Moon movie from the early 90s. Kind of in the same vein here, we have one that's just brand new, if I'm not mistaken, from last year, I guess, technically, but just released now. And this is Brain Tumor. And this is by Glenn Coburn. Glenn Coburn ran Whacked Films and released a few movies here and there. He also directed Bloodsuckers from Outer Space from 1984, which has had a couple releases now. Vinegar Syndrome put it out at one point, but Brain Tumor. So I was interested in this. I met Glenn Coburn, I think, at Cinema Wasteland. Very nice guy. I read his book, Whacked Movies, the review book. He's a pretty cool guy as well. Nice guy. But as far as Brain Tumor goes, this movie is micro-budget. It's got a weird tone. It's definitely a weird comedic tone that probably peaked in 10 years ago with just the kind of humor. It's very Troma-esque, I would say, because there's a lot of social and political and just humor in there, making fun of the healthcare system, making fun of, you know, extreme right, all that kind of stuff in here. But the humor does seem like 5 to 10 years old at this point, but I mean, it's still never going to get old, right? As far as the special effects are concerned, let's get into the story, I guess. We have this brain surgeon who is terrible at his job. He's a drunk. He's the main character. He accidentally loses a tumor. He pulls out of somebody's brain. This thing lands in basically a bedpan, gets covered in urine, turns into a giant monster, starts picking off people involved with the hospital. There's a twist at the very end that ties that in, why it's picking those people. But essentially what happens is the doctor, his son, and his son's girlfriend are trying to stop this giant brain tumor that's growing. It looks very cheap, but it is fun, and it is endearing, the creature. As far as the acting is concerned, it leaves a lot, to be honest. The doctor, you know, he has the tone, what they're going for here. It's a weird tonal kind of acting, and it's done on purpose. So if you like it, you might be able to get over some of it. But even then, saying that, even when they are trying to do that tone, it does seem like a lot of people are trying not to laugh. This, like I said, super micro budget. The digital effects are horrible. The green screen effects are horrible. The plot is fun. There's some funny dialogue in there, I will admit. There's a couple moments that kind of are decent. But overall, Brain Tumor is just kind of a really, really low budget movie about a little creature that kind of eats people and drowns them. The kills aren't amazing. The special effects aren't amazing, but if you like do-it-yourself cinema, you might want to give this one a spin. If not, you know, check out the trailer. You know you like it or not, but the cover's pretty fun. Yeah, and there's some of the line delivery. It's just bizarre. So bizarre, it has to be on purpose. You know what I mean? All right, let's hop into those 1981 movies.
Woe be unto him who opens one of the 7 gateways to hell, because through that gateway, evil will invade the world.
Thank you. Valentine's Day is a curse that'll live on. And no one will know as the years come and go of the horror from long time ago. In this little town, when the 14th comes round, there's a silence and fear in the air. Remember the morn that the legend was born, all the shock and the horror was there. For the legend, they say, on a Valentine's Day is a curse that'll live on and on. And no one will know as the years come and go of the horror from long time ago. And no one will know as the years come and go of the horror from long time ago.
Okay, guys, I'm going to be brief with this one because next week, after you see this in a few days, we'll have the Burial Ground feature review with Bruce Holchek and Art Edgerop. So we're just going to talk briefly about the 4K of Burial Ground by Severin Films. Man, Burial Ground in 1981, Sicky by Andrea Bianchi, who did Strip Nude for Your Killer and Cry of the Prostitute and a slew of other pretty nasty, sleazy films. This essentially was a video store classic if you grew up any time when the video stores were open. Very iconic VHS cover art. So essentially what we have here is a group of middle-aged people going into a rich mansion. They're rich people. Three couples and one of their kids, played by Peter Bark, who is a small person. They end up going as a child for good reason. There's some incestuous stuff that's going to happen in this movie. So there's also a professor there and a maid and a butler. What happens is the professor, before they get there, unveils something in this catacombs and releases a bunch of zombies that look like a cross between Tombs of the Blind Dead and Fulci's Zombie. So these zombies come in, and while the people are having sex and having fun, they start to attack them in very slow, relentless pace. They're slow, but they do not stop, and they basically rip these people to pieces. That's essentially the plot of Burial Ground. The music is strange. The atmosphere is strange. The acting is strange. The dubbing is strange. A lot of people call it so bad, it's so good. I call it so weird, it's good. I think that Burial Ground is one of those kind of weird midnight classics that's equal parts cheesy, sleazy, goofy, and scary, if that makes any sense. It's legitimately stupid and scary at the same time. I guess that would be most, serial killers, stupid and scary at the same time. But the 4K looks excellent. This movie was infamous for having kind of a dark kind of thing on VHS, and some of the DVDs and Blu-rays, Freak Show didn't do too great of a job to try to fix it. I mean, it looked better, but then we had the Severin Blu-ray, which looked good, but now we have it on 4K. It looks fantastic. The music's fantastic. It's just a fun, crazy movie. If you don't believe me, believe the Black Spider and the prophecy of him. So basically what we have here is two audio commentaries, one with Troy Haworth and Eugenio Urquilaghi, and then we have another audio commentary with Callum Waddell and John Martin. I prefer the first one with Troy because the other one's not a bad commentary, but it more focuses on the horror scene in general, not Burial Ground, which is fine. And then the Blu-ray disc has some special features: Villa Parisi, Legacy of Terror, local featurette, and this is a place where a bunch of horror films were filmed. Return of the Burial Ground, interview with actor Peter Bark at Villa Parisi. Peter Still Is Festival Q&A with Peter Bark. They love that Peter Bark guy. Just for the Money, interview with actor Simone Mottoli. The Smell of Death, interviews with producer Gabrielle Christini and actress Margilotti Jean Darno. Deleted and extended material, which includes nudity, if I remember correctly. So great release from Severin. Looks great in 4K. Sounds great in 4K. Yes, I'm Your Friend. A great movie. Great movie. First up from 1981 is going to be kind of a shockumentary. There's going to be a couple of these. So since I watched Faces of Death, I was like, you know what? There's going to be a couple of my watch. And the first one is The Killing of America from Severin Films. Now, I've seen this before, and this is a really dark documentary. And it's weird because when you watch this, it's like the politics of it are kind of like very anti-gun, but also they like seem to be like anti-violence. And it's weird. Like nowadays, it would be both like yelled at for being like super liberal and super conservative at the same time. It's strange. Like, they stick up for cops constantly, but then they hate that there's a million guns in America. It's so funny to watch old documentaries and see what they're trying to get at. But essentially, this opens up with the assassination attempt at Ronald Reagan, and it ends with the assassination of John Lennon. Kind of two modern assassination attempts in the world. And then it starts off going back to early violence in America, and it goes all the way up into more modern violence, talking about serial killers, and has interviews with serial killers like Kenneth Bianchi and Edmund Kemper and all these kind of nasty people like that footage like that. And there's a lot of real footage in here, but you know, as much as it is shocking and is disturbing, there is a lot of interesting stuff to be had. Not everyone ends in tragedy. Some end kind of in a different way, but for the most part, this one doesn't seem, although it is exploitative, it doesn't come across as bad as something like some of the, not nearly as bad as Traces of Death. And this one is incredibly intriguing to me, just because you're seeing them look at this violence in a different time frame, a different lens, right? And how they looked at it now, and how many things have changed and how many things haven't changed. We're talking about Charles Whitman in the Tower, all sorts of this stuff here. And a lot of footage that you probably haven't seen, and a lot of way it's spun in a certain way. Overall, I really enjoy The Killing of America. I think it's the best shockumentary of the year, compared to Faces of Death 2 and the other one I'll be talking about this week. Kind of that one. But English language version here, we have original 95 minutes, and the Japanese version is almost 2 hours. It's 10 minutes longer. Audio commentary by director Sheldon Rennie. The Madness is Real, interview with director Sheldon Rennie. And then Cutting, is it Rennie or Renan? Cutting the Killing, interview with editor Lee Percy, interview with Mondo movie historian Nick Pinkerton. So yeah, this is great. This is one of the best of the Mondo movies, hands down, along with like Mondo Kani and The First Faces of Death, I would say, are kind of like the stellar ones. Maybe you could skip the rest of them after that, but I would really recommend Killing of America if you've never seen it. Okay, the next Mondo movie is Great White Death. I'm going to be very brief with this one. I do not own a copy. It's narrated by Glenn Ford, and he basically just talks about sharks and how dangerous sharks are. And then after a while, we start talking to all sorts of different sharks. It's very bland. It's very kind of meh. There's some underwater footage. And then we even talk about stingrays. I don't know why this is listed as horror. I guess there's some semi-reenactments. But in reality, this is just kind of a documentary you'd watch on Shark Week, with Glenn Ford narrating, aka Pirates of the Deep. This is going to be the shortest review of the bunch, I'm not kidding. But what's hilarious, at the very end, they got Glenn Ford, it's like, I wonder who the real Pirates of the Deep are. And I was thinking, I wonder who the real cannibals are. I'm like, what's going on here? You stop that right now. But obviously, Glenn Ford is a well-respected, great actor. This year, he did Happy Birthday to Me. He also was in Virus the year previous, and he's in a million, like, really kind of quality films. He's a good narrator, he's got a great voice, he's got a good screen presence, but I can't really comment on just, you know, watching a bunch of shark footage and the picture they're trying to paint. It's just kind of, why? You know, if you've seen one of these, you've seen 1,000 of them, and it's nothing special. It's nothing gratuitous. It's just, it is what it is. It's, you know, some kind of borderline reenactments, if I'm not mistaken, and that's about it. Some shark footage. Not for me. Okay, the next one up is a doozy. And this is, you know, it's not listed as a horror film, but I feel like it kind of is. And this is Roar from 1981. Now, this feels like a documentary, and you can almost watch the narrative film in there and then look behind it and just see the documentary being made behind the scenes. So essentially what this film is there's this guy who lives with all these wild cats in, isn't it Africa, I believe, or somewhere around those areas. He brings a lot of wild cats that don't belong there. He has lions, tigers, jaguars, panthers, pumas, and panthers, I think, are the same thing, and some elephants too. And he lives secluded here, and he essentially, right in the very beginning, somebody comes to visit to clean the house, and they're constantly being like attacked by these lions, and this guy's keeping this amazing positive attitude, like, no, you gotta be special with the lions. It's essentially Bob Ross if he raised a bunch of wild cats. He's a complete fucking annoyance and a moron, and he just drives me crazy. Did I just sing Britney Spears? The show's done. We're out of here. We're done. We're leaving. Never talking again. But essentially, Roar. His family actually comes in, and he's gone at the time because he had to do something ridiculous, because this guy never pre-plans a damn thing. He's a moron. And it's Trippi Redburn and Melanie Griffin and like actual real family, from my understanding, playing themselves, kind of. And they are stalked by these cats for a good 20 to 30 minutes. They're all hiding. And it's truly a horror film at that point. And it's scarier than a lot of the animal attacks movies. It's like those old school animal attacks movies, right? When they have like the pack with dogs are literally jumping through the window and you're like, holy shit, or Wild Beast, where you're like, what are they doing here? They're literally just like wild, like animals about to kill me in this movie. And this has that vein too. Big cats scare the shit out of me, I'm not gonna lie. Elephants do too, but I love elephants. Big cats, just never, I don't dislike them, but they're just, I've always been very weary of them, as you should be. But a lot of the stuff in here is terrifying. And they paint the picture, there's these two cats that are constantly at each other's throats because one's an alpha and one's not an alpha. But the footage alone is worth watching just to see these people interact with these big cats. And all, everybody on the set got injured. No animals were harmed in the making of this film. 70 cast and crew members were. And I completely believe it. The most dangerous film ever made. That's 100% accurate. The lead in the movie is just so annoying, though, because he keeps that positive attitude when really you can like see sometimes the people are trying to act like they're relaxed, and then a cat will move and they're like, like they're terrified. Like you could just tell that this is absolutely horrifying. This is an Olive Films release. Roar. Check it out if you can. Recommend it just for the curious film goer for sure. It's got some crazy shit in it. Okay, next up is from the Tosh Ho trilogy, and we covered Zeiger Weinenweisen last year, or for 1980. I think it probably was last year. This week, we're going to cover Kajiro Za, which is by Shannon Suzuki, Shuzan Suzuki, who did the other film as well. But yeah, so essentially this one is kind of listed as a fantasy mystery thriller, and I figured that was horror enough. So we follow this character who is essentially a playwright, and he kind of runs into this ghostly kind of woman, and she talks about these cherry blossoms, cherry bladders, and they start talking, and he mentions that he knew someone who was poisoned. This old lady is trying to give them to her, and she's terrified of it. And over a couple times, he runs into her two or three more times, and it's no longer a coincidence. He thinks something's going on with them. He tells his kind of boss who produces, who runs the theater and everything like that, what's going on, this rich kind of asshole kind of character. And before long, he's just be kind of obsessed with this woman, and they start to have this kind of relationship, and he doesn't even know if she's alive or dead. She's very mysterious. He doesn't understand any of it, but as it progresses, we learn that there's more that meets the eye. There's some people pulling the strings, and there's possibly this guy has two wives, one of which is deceased, so you really don't know where it's going or how it's going to go. But there, he gets a letter one day that says, you know, I want to die with my lover in a suicide pact. And it progresses from there. The movie is 2 hours and 20 minutes long. It does drag a little, I'm not going to lie. But visually, it looks great. It's very well acted. And for the runtime, it does keep your interest. I did want to see what happened here. It ends in kind of a really kind of cool, magical, kind of not magical, but very creative kind of play. I wouldn't call it magical, but overall I think that Kajiro Za is interesting, and I think that Tony Raines, he kind of explains what that means. Was it like shining light play or something like that, or like a performance? It's an interesting movie. Would I call it an all horror movie? No. Would I say that it's interesting to horror fans? Probably a lot. The more adventurous horror fans, I would say it is. And there's just an introduction by Tony Raines on this disc that's about 19 minutes, which does give a lot of context and how this movie got made, because the previous film he made was very big hit, and it was 1980. This one was 81, and then the third of this trilogy didn't get made until 1991, if that tells you anything. So yeah, good film. This is going to be very brief. We have 9 short films from 1981 here. This is the short film block. We're getting there. So these movies may only get 30 seconds because it's a short film, and I don't want to spoil everything. Let's stay focused on the one camera. So first up, we have Pickman's Model, which is obviously based off the Lovecraft story. This is a black and white 30-minute short. This is pretty decent. So essentially, we kind of have the structure of this guy talking about how he's become obsessed and how he's like damaged from this. Basically, he's an art guy, and he's writing books about it, trying to publish all these different occult things and books and everything. And he's obsessed with Pikmin. He says when he sees Pikmin's pictures, he feels different. He feels disgusting. Of course, there's a twist at the end. If you know the Lovecraft story, something about transformation and body horror and Premonition. Decent short. Not great, but not horrible. The next one up is Silver Slime by Christoph Gans, who did, of course, Brotherhood of the Wolf, if I'm not mistaken. He also did Necronomicon. He did a short in that one. And this one's about 15 minutes long, and this is a Giallo-style kind of monster slime thing. This one is super creative. Definitely more of a style over substance here. This is probably the best short of the bunch. I love the music. I love just how quick it is. The violence, just really good. Silver Slime. Check it out. Next up is is Deaf Man's Glance, and this one is very kind of slow and morose, and it kind of just a bizarre one about this woman who's cleaning quietly and then goes in and kills somebody, a young child. And I can't know Deaf Man's Glance is based on a story as well, a classic story just from the title alone, but I've never read it, so I can't really comment too much. This one's just mediocre to me. It doesn't have any super amazing, like, well-made things about it, but it's not horrible either. It's very mediocre. The next one up is The Visitant, and this one's fun. This is low-budget, do-it-yourself, but it has a certain quality to it that I like, the most energy of the bunch, I'd say, besides Silver Slime. So essentially what we have here is this guy's visiting his son's grave, his 7-year-old son, and his son's there. So he starts chasing him, and pretty soon he learns that, you know, it's not, it's Friday the 13th in November from the opening narration, and, you know, maybe there's more that meets the eye to this story, you know, maybe he doesn't, maybe more than just his son belong there as well. You get what's going on here. Next up is Flesh on Glass, and this is a bizarre one. We kind of follow the story of this woman who becomes obsessed with her brother's wife and starts kind of like this weird kind of sexual relationship or closeness to her, and she kind of like becomes obsessed and kind of downgrades and goes kind of like completely insane. It's really weird. It's really well made. It's really well acted. This is probably one of the best of the shorts just in terms of quality and acting, and there's a lot of breaking glass at the very end, if I'm not mistaken. Next up is Beneath the Skin, and this is by the director of Possibly in Michigan, which is a popular short which I need to watch, but Beneath the Skin is frickin' weird. So essentially it kind of goes the storyline of we have this woman just kind of narrating and talking, and she's like, she dated a serial killer at one point, and she's just talking about, you know, the finding the head in the closet and all these kind of things like that, and it keeps cutting back to imagery, weird imagery that we've seen before, a lot of repeated imagery, and just a lot of unsettlingness. It's very experimental, and it's obviously there to just show you repeated imagery and say really weird twisted things to kind of give you an uncomfortable feeling, and it works. And the lady saying it sounds kind of like just really silly. Next up is Toro, Toro, Toro. This is actually directed by Scott Spiegel and Josh Becker from the kind of Sam Raimi, Bruce Campbell crew. Obviously, these guys did tons of great movies. Toro, Toro, Toro is like 7 minutes long. It's absolutely hilarious. It's like a Three Stooges skit. It's about a killer lawnmower that goes and runs amok. It's only made to do a lot of creative, silly, fun shots. You know, the lawnmower shoots a bunch of pies at people. You get exactly what you're going for in this. Just exactly what you'd expect that crew to make about a killer lawnmower with as many sight gags as you can possibly get into it. You know, it's a Three Stages kind of gag, never stops. Then we have Haunted Indiana, and this is kind of like a public access thing where it's like 4 short stories. It's like 19 minutes, but there are 4 short stories in here. A lot of people like this public access kind of stuff. It's okay. It's kind of mediocre, but then again, you kind of expect it. It's got a weird quality local charm to it, of course, but there's a story about what, like a creature. There's a story about a shadow following a guy. None of them really stand out. They're all kind of meh, but there is a monster one in there which might kind of interest people. It's okay. Next up and last up is Hungry Grass, which is a pretty short one, about 5 minutes long, and this one I think is Irish, and it opens up about this guy telling him about the potato famine and how he came back to Ireland to kind of look up his ancestors in his graveyard, and they explain what Hungry Grass is, and we learn what Hungry Grass is for this guy. I'll leave it at that one. This one's pretty interesting, pretty short, doesn't wear out its welcome, and worth watching for sure. So that's the short film block from 1981. That's 9 films. There's also Dr. Anchando's Theater, which I did review, and there's one of the shorts on Letterboxd that's from that. I'm not going to re-watch that and re-review it because I already covered all that and that thing. But anyways, I think I covered all the shorts that are widely available from 1981. Most are on YouTube. If you search around, you can find the others pretty easy. But yeah. Okay, for the Patreon pick, we got Blow Up. And I'm not going to be as in-depth as I think a lot of people would like me to be on this. This is Antonioni's Blow Up. Obviously, later on, they would make Blow Out. Brian De Palma would, because of being such a fan of Blow Up. So this follows David Hemmings, classic actor from Deep Red and a million other things. David Hemmings is an underrated actor, I think. I know he gets a lot of love, but he's not really mentioned as much as he should be, I guess, now. I mean, they mention his name, but they never say how good he is or how interesting of an actor he is. So essentially, David Hemmings is a photographer. He's really strict. He's really kind of an asshole, and he's just really aggressive with the models. He's a high kind of fashion photographer, and he's doing all these things. And like, during the middle of the session, he decides to just leave because he's either frustrated or tired, and he kind of walks out. There's a lot of good camera work here following him around. There's a lot of great set designs. Every shot's pretty beautiful, I'm not going to lie. And he ends up going to this antique shop, and this whole scene is great. He goes there earlier, too, and his interactions with the old man are pretty top-notch, pretty funny. But he goes back, and he wants to buy this propeller, but before he's taking these pictures out in the street, and there's the stillness and the wind and the grass and the background and the cemetery, or the park, it just feels real. You've ever been out there by yourself? I remember when you used to explore by yourself, when you first get a car, or when you go for walks and everything, and you realize it just feels completely isolated and completely free, and you hear the wind, and everything is just gorgeous. Maybe it's about the thunderstorm. That's kind of the feeling I got. And there is a storm coming, and maybe in his mind what he's going to shoot with this camera. But regardless, I thought that was probably my favorite scene in the movie, just something so simple like that, the way it was framed, the way the sound design came in. So essentially, he starts to wander in this park, and he starts to shoot Samantha Eggert. Or is it Vanessa Redgrave? It's Vanessa Redgrave. Sorry, I always confuse the two, but it's Vanessa Redgrave. He starts to film her with this man from a distance, and she begs him for the camera reels and all these kind of things, and he starts to kind of blackmail her a little bit, brings her back, says, I'll give them back, just come, and she's offering herself, tries to steal them, but what he finds out was in these negatives, it's not just an affair, which is what he thought. There is an attempted murder until he pushes forward and goes through and realizes that someone was murdered. So he becomes obsessed with getting a picture of the body, and no one else seems to really care. And by the end of the film, it kind of ends in such a weird note. Overall, I think that Blow Up is obviously a classic about obsession, about, you know, there's a lot of things to talk about. The more I tried to hear other people talk about the movie, the less I liked what they were saying. I mean, it felt very broad. What they were saying was very broad and just saying themes and everything like that. And I just wasn't very personal, if that makes any sense to them. And I just didn't dig it. So I this is pretty much all I could say about Blow Up. I enjoyed it. I liked it. I thought that the acting, the cinematography, the framing was all top notch. And a movie about somebody, you know, a photographer is interesting. Obviously, this character is not going to fly today. He's a very dated character. He's very misogynistic. But it is what it is, you know what I mean? And the 60s and 70s characters tended to have a lot of these characters. Now, they're not all great people. And sometimes you feel like, sometimes people do think that the director is putting himself in there. It's not always the case at all. Mostly it's not the case. But Blow Up, I really enjoyed it. There's a lot of special features on the Criterion. We have new pieces about director Antonioni's artistic approach, featuring photography curators Walter Moser and Felipe Gardner and art historian David Allen Miller. Blow Up or Blow Up, a 2016 documentary making a film, conversations from 2016 between Gardner and actor Vanessa Redgrave, archival interviews with Antonioni and actors David Hemmings and Jane Birkin, trailers, a book featuring an essay by film scholar David Fogas, an updated 1966 account of the film shooting by Stig Borkman, the questionnaires the directors distributors to photographers and painters while developing the film, and the 1959 Julio Cortazar short story on which the film is loosely based. I unfortunately didn't get to watch any of these features, so I wasn't talking about them. I was just talking about reviews in general. But regardless, it flies by pretty quick, too. And it's a gorgeous-looking movie, so check it out. Blow Up. All right, let's get these questions, comments, concerns. Kentucky, Kentuckinator, latter-day slashers. I like that term. I'm gonna steal it. Brendan Timmons. I need to track down the Zulkin set. It's an exact kind of art house genre cinema that I love to have on the shelf. I hope you enjoy it. Ken Coakley, the original choice to play Carl Kersey in Death Wish was Jack Lemmon, but he fell out of the project and was replaced by Charles Bronson. Death Wish is based on a novel that portrays Kersey as a bleeding heart liberal turned vigilante. He was also considered to be a real villain in the book. I saw the first Death Wish at a drive-in, in which With Fear is the Key, a movie reviewed a couple of weeks ago. Besides Jeff Goldblum, there was some other up-and-comers. One of the cops was played by Christopher Guest of Spinal Tap. Yeah, he's great in it. He's the very end. Lawrence Hilton's Jacob, who later became a TV star with Welcome Back, Kotter, played a mugger. I also watched George Romero's Amusement Park for the first time. I really loved it. It was a surreal, but still had that Romero flavor. It's also heartbreaking to see the elder abuse, because being in a nursing home, I see old people, and like a lot of them, there was an elderly woman who was depressed, and one of the nurses thought I could cheer her up. I was supposed to make her laugh, but instead she made me laugh. She saw my long hair and beard and told me I looked like the guy she fucked at Woodstock. That had me howling. Speaking of making me laugh, I had tears trickling down my face when you reviewed Invasion USA and mentioned that the soldiers looked like they were in traumas of war. That was hilarious. Thanks, man. I appreciate it. Hope you get better. I do. Stephen Hyde. He gives me a heart. Thank you. Subjective, perspective, collective. I owned The Fishmen. I didn't mind, definitely probably my least favorite film, Martino, but still had an okay time. Not as good as Island of Dr. Moreau. Yes, I'm talking about the Val Kilmer Marlon Brando. As always, great vid reviews. Take care, brother. You know what? I think I'm going to go on record and say Island of Dr. Moreau all three versions, even though I haven't seen the first Island of Lost Souls, is probably better than Island of the Fishmen. Nick Moore from Belgium. I know the 77 one is. I remember that one pretty well with Burt Lancaster and Michael Wagner? Is that Michael? Michael York, sorry. Nick Moore from Belgium. Death Wish. You almost forgot how effective, how excellent this feature is because all the sequels and how many times it got mocked and spoofed. They even had a semi-regular Bronson Death Wish skit on The Simpsons. Imagine that film leaves you even more distraught than before when experiencing it on 4K. It sure as hell had an effect on me when I saw it on an old color TV decades ago. You're mostly right about MVD's release of Candyland. The commentary is a little wonky. Another reviewer found out that is more of a scene select specific track and said track skips ahead at the 35 minute point. It corrects itself later. Mr. Schwab offered up some more information, maybe even too much. Apparently all the nudity was actually the actors, no doubles were used. William Baldwin knew he had to cry over Levy's corpse, but was quite surprised to find his co-star lying there completely nude. Arts is a harsh mistress for sure, right? Questions. Did something unexpectedly good or bad ever happen on any of the projects you worked on? I mean, there's lots of stuff that unexpected. Movies were completely lost. Filmed the whole movie, crashed, gone on a movie. That was horrible. Something positive that happened, you know, basically, maybe actors couldn't do the role and somebody else filled in. How skilled do you have to be to make a decent Blu-ray? I don't know. I've never made one, but probably not too scared. If you got it, if you know it, you'll be all right. How good is the original Toolbox Murders? I'm thinking of acquiring it. It's pretty decent. The first 30 minutes is excellent, and then it kind of slows down to police procedural kind of stuff. Not police, but there's procedural stuff. It's an all right movie. The first half is way better. Cameron Mitchell's really good in it. LOLLIPOP spells lollipop. Yeah, he's great in it. I hope and pray that this year unfolds. You'll be in perfect health and high spirits. Till next time, young grasshopper. Thank you. David Leather. War of the Worlds Next Century sounds amazing. Thanks. P.S. You don't have permission to die. I guess not. And then he says, French is the worst for everyone. Yes. And he says, Wilfred Matowski says, Proism. That's probably when I was hyping myself up there, right? But yeah, let's hop into this update. All right, guys, let's hop into this. First up is Valentine. It was on sale around Valentine's Day. I picked it up. You know what? I've never seen Valentine, the old kind of slasher, post-Scream slasher, but it looks fun. We got, from Scream Factory, of course. And then we have this one here. This is Degasser Video, and, man, this is called what? I can't even read it. Horacio Diabolica. So this is a Spanish, or this is a Mexican one. And I think I had a bootleg VHS of this and never got to watch. It's got a little small person killer clown in it. Should be fun. I'm sure it's entertaining. Obviously, Degasser is kind of the it can't be perfectly remastered, so that's kind of the deal. That's a sub-label they have. They put out Redneck Zombies. Then we have Saturn's Core. We have Zombie Army. It's been a long time since I watched this. Had this bad boy on VHS. Yeah, so this one ends. I almost spoiled the ending for you guys. But, I mean, do you guys really care about a SOV Zombie Army cheapy movie released? Was this a Video Outlaw tape? Probably was. But, yeah, I'm not going to give it a hold hard to recommend. But I remember, you know, watching it a couple times. And then up next, we have Five Car Stud with Dean Martin and Robert Mitchum. That sounds pretty good. Some classic actors there. Vinegar Syndrome here. One of the sub-label here. Yeah, VSL. Love Westerns. Good actors, too. Gotta love Robert Mitchum. If you don't love Robert Mitchum, I don't know what to tell you. A Man Called Hero. VSA. Pretty cool. Man on the Brink. This is a good movie from 1981. A Hong Kong movie. Definitely more of a thriller action piece, but it does have exploitative qualities too. Good movie. I've covered this one before. This is from Connie. I wish I would have waited now, but hey, it's all right. I won't mind rewatching that one. It's pretty good. Next up here we have... French. French is the worst, and it's not French. Yeah, it's definitely French. Regine Pendovani, a film by Denis Arcand, and So this is the DistroPix, Canadian Pictures. They always put out good stuff, so I try to grab some of their stuff all the time. But I hate French, man. I cannot do French. And then we have Blind Faith. I've heard of this one before. I've actually never seen it, though, but this is VHS Shitfest. What a crazy title. I meant just their title, their label. The line between pain and pleasure is thin as a razor. Ooh, that's pretty dark, guys. That's pretty fucking dark. Then we got Phase 4 here. It's been a long time since I watched Phase 4. This is a VS one right here, Vinegar Syndrome. It's hard to remember what's a sub-label. Got a book here. This is 4K, I think. And this is actually directed by Saul Bass, who did a lot of like the openings for movies, Psycho and stuff. I think he edited the shower scene, if I'm not mistaken. But this movie's got a kind of a big cult following. It's probably considered the best Killer Ant movie. I seen it years ago, but I was not ready for an art film. I was ready for a Killer Ant movie. So, I will definitely rewatch it. I'm sure I'll grow appreciation for it, but it's a bizarre film, if I'm not mistaken, honestly. Next up here, we have Spanish Bloodbath. We have Night of the Skull, Violent Bloodbath, and The Fish with the Eyes of the Gold. Night of the Skull is at the Franco, and then Violent Bloodbath, that was the Jorge Grau? I think it was, and I'm not 100% sure. And the other one, A Fish with the Gold, Eye of Gold, I'm not too familiar with. But, so it looks like I might have been right here. Night of the Skull, I'm not 100% sure. That is directed by Jess Franco, and the other one is Jorge Grau. So that's great. Always love a Grau one getting released and a Franco. Gotta love that. Check them off the list. Finally, nice releases of those ones. Then we have The Playgirls and the Vampire. This might be another Spanish, or is this a Spanish or Mexican? I'm not 100% sure on this one. Spanish, most likely. So, very cool. I love my Euro horror, big time. And a DVD here for 1982. Angela Lansbury, George Hearn, and Sweeney Todd, The Demon Barber of Fleet Street, This is the original Broadway musical winner of 1979, but this is the 82 rendition. I think this is recorded in 82, so definitely going to be watching it for 1982. I do love the musical, not so big on the Tim Burton movie, but hey, it is what it is. We're out of here.
All right, guys, thank you very much for watching. As always, have a good one.